You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, grassroots, community supported, solar power,
yeah.
Community radio from here in the heartland, the cultural district of Fairfield, Iowa, broadcasting live on Friday, August 10th, or perhaps you're listening to our rebroadcast on Monday morning at 8 a.m. This is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It is a beautiful day. When I got up this morning, it was about 55 degrees. I couldn't believe it. But at any rate, it is a beautiful day, and we're thankful for a little bit of coolness here.
Yeah, 55, that's like half of what it was. I know.
So every day, you know, and the beautiful fluffy clouds, and everybody seems perky. You know, people were getting dragged down by the heat.
Yeah.
They didn't want to go anywhere. They didn't want to do anything, you know? And yeah. I understand that, because I had the same
I've always feeling. Thought that that was part of why, looking historically, it seems like civilizations advanced more in the northern areas of the world than around the equator. Although not early on. Of course, the Egyptians and the Mayans and so forth. I think back when it was, this is kind of off the subject, but back when survival was really an issue, it was harder to survive in the north, and so the warmer regions had had an advantage. But then once humanity got to the point where survival wasn't all everything, then I think the northern regions had an advantage because it's easier to be motivated when it's not so hot.
Yeah. You can keep
warm.
I can always put on enough clothes to keep warm, but I cannot take off enough clothes to keep cool.
Well, the weather we have now is a perfect time for writing.
Yes.
And our guest today is really the perfect guest for Writers' Voices, where we talk all about the writing process.
Absolutely.
Because today we have with us Roseanne Bain, who is the author of Around the Writer's Block, Using Brain Science to Solve Writer's Resistance, which was published this month by Tartra Penguin. She also teaches creativity classes for the Loft Literary Center and the University of Minnesota. I think I've been to the Loft Literary Center, if that's in Minneapolis. And she has coached over 115 clients. Coaching is her primary focus. And author of a number of other things that we will talk about. Roseanne, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Monica. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with how you've got so interested in the brain.
I got so interested in the brain because for a long time I've been pondering the whole question of, if it feels so good to write and be creative, and it does, then why do we have so many reasons and excuses for not writing and not doing what we want to do? I used to think it was just me, and then I started doing a lot of research, and then I started teaching, and I realized it's pretty much all writers. At some point or another, we run into some resistance, some reluctance to write. And I wrote one book, Dancing in the Dragon's Den, that looked at that question. And then I started doing a little more research in the brain. I actually read Joseph Ledeau's book, The Emotional Brain, and another book called The Brain That Changes Itself. And I started seeing some connections between what's going on in the brain and what's happening with our writing. And a couple of things in Ledeau's book just were light bulb moments for me and made me realize, oh, this is what's happening. Well, that made me very excited to share that with other people.
Wow.
So you had those aha moments, huh?
Yes. Those are so much fun.
Yeah. Right.
And another one of your influences, based on your website, and also you refer to it in the book a lot, is Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. A Stroke of Insight. Stroke of Insight.
Her book is just fascinating. You know, it's entirely anecdotal. It's her experience of having a massive stroke that shut down the left hemisphere of her brain. So it's not based on the research, but she herself is a neuroanatomist, and so she has all that background. So her insights into the differences between the two hemispheres was really fascinating.
It really is. We spoke with her a few years ago on Writers' Voices, so you can check that out on writersvoices.com.
In your archives.
In our archives, yeah.
Yes.
So it's, yeah, it was, what a story, and just the ability to be able to document it. It's one of a kind, really.
Absolutely.
There aren't too many people who are experiencing that have her background and her ability to, the ability that she had to actually recognize what was going on. And understand
and to be able to describe it.
And be able to describe it, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting that after her 8-year recovery, she realized there were parts of her personality and parts of her brain function that she didn't want to bring back.
Yeah.
She's doing a lot more art and playing her guitar and doing stained glass and has less of that driven part of her, which I think is very interesting.
It is very interesting, and how much did that influence your development of some of the components that you are recommending for overcoming writer's resistance?
Well, actually, her work is very informative for my perspective on process, which is one of the three habits that I recommend for writers and other creative people. It's a creative play for the sake of creative play. And my first awareness grew out of Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. She talks about morning pages, and which is basically writing first thing in the morning, just stream of consciousness, whatever comes to you. And that is a very effective way of doing creative process, but it's not the only way that we can do that. And when Jill Bolte Taylor talks about the differences between the two hemispheres, that process, willingness to play without an outcome that you're looking for. So you don't have an intention. You're not trying to accomplish anything. You're just playing for the sake of play. That's a very right hemisphere state of mind. And really what we need as creative people is to have a collaboration between the left and right hemispheres. And the left hemisphere is usually so bossy and noisy that we have to make a conscious effort to tune into the right hemisphere.
Well, you talk about not just the relationship between the left and right hemisphere, but also the, you know, the reptilian brain, the animal brain, and the higher functioning. So, but maybe before we get into that, we'll have you read a little bit from your introduction so our listeners can understand where you're coming from on this.
Okay, great. I'd be delighted. Thank you. So this is from chapter one, and it starts with, what do they got that I ain't got? Some people seem able to write no matter what's going on. Work stress, a flood of family activities and responsibilities, health issues, a string of rejection letters, a furnace that quits in Minnesota in February. These people have more willpower than the rest of us, more discipline. Are they less susceptible to distractions, or are they just more self-centered? The students and coaching clients I work with aren't more disciplined, focused, or self-focused than most people. But they show up for their writing and themselves because they've learned how to harness the power of habit. They've learned what's going on in their brains when they're feeling resistance and what they can do to move through that resistance. I give them encouragement, information, and tools to figure out how to make writing part of their lives. But the truth is, they're the ones who show up and do the work. They've helped me refine my coaching and hone the basic practices that create sustainable habits. I thank and applaud them all. You'll want to thank them, too, when you learn what they know about fighting resistance and showing up for your writing. This book is for all of us who love to write and yet avoid our writing at least some of the time. It's for all of us who want to write but can't figure out where to start or what to say, promise ourselves we'll write someday, and miss opportunities to write right now. Find that our home gets cleaner and cleaner the closer we come to a deadline. Edit our first page over and over and over and feel unable or unworthy to move on. It's for those of us who keep our schedules so full we don't have time to write or take care of everyone else before writing. It's for those of us who suddenly remember 10 other things that require immediate attention before we sit down to write. It's for those of us who procrastinate and delay our dreams, who delay or fail to meet deadlines, who play it safe and avoid the risk of being fully present and vulnerable on the page. It's for all of us who give our time to writing projects that neither challenge nor excite us, or who sabotage her own efforts with lost files, accidents, or missed appointments. When we sit down in our writing space only to pop out of the chair to get a drink, a snack, another book to research, or we sit down at our computers to write, but first we have to check and respond to the email, Twitter, and Facebook, and somehow an hour goes by and we never quite got to the writing. Or we never quite make our way to the writing space at all. We distract ourselves with a multitude of other things to do and think about. We keep promising ourselves that someday soon we'll go back to the novel, the poems, the essay about Great Aunt Ruby. And while we're promising ourselves we'll return to what gives us such joy, some small part of us knows that we're lying. Why do we have such a love-fear relationship with our writing? What is it about writing that both attracts us and repels us? Why is it so difficult to do the very thing we love? Fortunately, not every writer is going to experience the full paralysis of full-blown writer's block, but every writer experiences some kind of resistance from time to time. It doesn't matter whether you're writing for your career, to finish a degree, or for personal satisfaction. It doesn't matter whether you've published for years or if you're still looking for your first publishing credit. What matters is not whether you will face resistance, but how you'll face it. Resistance shows up in many different ways. Some writers get anxious, and let's face it, there's plenty to be nervous about. Being rejected, rejecting yourself, harsh criticism, offending people, indifference, worst of all, not being able to write, not being able to write anything worthwhile, or not writing well and not knowing it until you've made a fool of yourself in public. Sometimes we're aware of the fear and how it keeps us from our writing. Other times we don't recognize that it's fear that's making us so susceptible to distractions despite our desire to write. Some writers get nasty, horribly critical of themselves and others and openly mean in expressing that criticism. Some writers get busy, distracting themselves from the underlying fear by keeping themselves too busy to write. Some writers get tired, falling on a spectrum that runs from giving in to the sudden, overwhelming need for a nap to chronic fatigue to clinical depression. And some of us get rebellious. Who do I think I am, telling me what to do? Some of us get wimpy or vague. Of course I'll write. About something. But first, for many of us, resistance is a shape changer, shifting from one form to another. Just when we start to recognize what's going on, the resistance finds a new form. The reassuring part is that all of this is normal. It's not comfortable, but it is normal. Resistance is part of the writing life. What makes or breaks us is not whether or how we experience resistance, it's how we respond to it. And most writers respond badly. We criticize ourselves. We push, we drive, we threaten, we bully. We question our ability, our commitment, our character. We must stop doing this. It is completely ineffective. It drains the joy out of writing. And sometimes, in the worst-case scenarios, the resistance wins out, and someone who could have been a really good writer gives up on writing altogether. Mm-hmm. Resistance can be resolved. That's the best news of all. Resistance is not about laziness, lack of willpower, or the failure of intellect and imagination. It's about neurology and psychology. And when we know what's happening in our brain when we feel resistant, we can learn how to respond effectively. And the best response is to write around the resistance. We need simple practices that bring us to our writing space regularly. We need commitments that are meaningful enough to engage us and small enough to give us confidence that we can keep showing up no matter what. One of the common things I hear from my law students is a bemused confession that even though they love to write, they seem to have an unending supply of excuses for not writing what they really want to. And they're shocked by how much time has passed since they wrote consistently, or surprised they aren't writing regularly, even though it's been months since they finished whatever it was they thought was delaying their writing, earning the master's degree, getting the kids out of diapers, getting the kids off to college, completing a major project at work, retiring. And that's where we start, with the awareness that their current methods aren't working. I promise my students that they can have a sustainable and satisfying writing practice based on three habits: process, product time, and self-care, and that these three habits will make it possible to show up for the writing. Then and only then can they return to the joy and satisfaction that comes from doing what they love to do. It's still difficult at times because resistance is omnipresent. They know how to show up and write in spite of that resistance.
That was Roseanne Bain reading from the introduction to Around the Writer's Block, Using Brain Science to Solve Writer's Resistance, including writer's block, procrastination, paralysis, perfectionism, postponing, distraction, self-sabotage, excessive criticism, overscheduling, and endlessly delaying your writing.
I was so delighted that my editor allowed me to include the part of that title.
Now, I started a writer's group at my church, ladies my age, and some are retired, some are still working, but I'm having trouble getting people to join me because I have three or four ones that come every time, but they always say, oh, I can't write, or I'm a terrible speller, and I say, well,
we're not grading spelling.
And see, someone told them sometime that they couldn't write, that they were not good writers, and that has stuck with them.
And often that we're not even conscious of whatever it is that's creating that anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even have to be conscious of the anxiety for it to affect us and to keep us away from our writing. And I think that's really sad.
Well, what I want to do is help them to remember themselves in writing and things that happen to them, things that happen to their family, to write them down before they're lost. Because, oh, golly, I wish I had asked my mother so many things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody tells me that. Oh, yeah, I wish I'd asked my mother this or my mother that. And if you had, then you could write it. But if you write down now what you experienced, then your children won't have to say that.
Yes. And that's such a gift, Carolyn, that you're giving other people the encouragement to write.
Yeah. I enjoy it. I really do. You know, it's a great deal of fun. I just wonder how to get more people into it. So any ideas you can give me, I will be grateful for.
I think what you're doing is probably really effective. I think reminding people why it might be important for them to write and encouraging them that it's not about the spelling, it's not about the punctuation, it's not about any of the things that you were criticized for when you were in grade school or high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of discovering that writing is, someone famous, might have been Peter Elbow, it might have been someone else, said that writing is discovery. I don't know what I think until I start to write it down.
Exactly.
Oh, right. Good point.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah. Well, this one lady had, her husband was very ill, and she was caring for him, and she started writing a memoir about him as he was a farmer and the things that he did on the farm, and that's how she got started. And then he passed away, and her granddaughter read that memoir at the funeral, and she told me yesterday, she said I'm so grateful that you got me started doing that, because that really meant a lot to the family. And it,
yes,
you know, it did.
Yes, it does. And we always think, oh, I'll remember that, and you know, when you're 20, you do remember it.
Right.
It's 50. Like, I thought I'd remember something, but I can't remember what it was. So,
exactly.
Writing can be a way of documenting family history and keeping track of that and providing a small legacy for your family, for the people who come after you. It can be a way of changing the world. It can be a way of, you know, entertaining people. There's so many reasons to write and so many opportunities to do it.
It can be a way of changing yourself.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I sometimes say that I think that creativity feels so good, especially in the beginning, because it's the divine's way of luring us to take the spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
That any creative thing we start with, we start because it's fun and it's engaging and I'm having a good time, but sooner or later you come to a place where you start encountering some parts of yourself that you wouldn't otherwise. And that is a journey worth taking.
When I was in my 20s, I remember once my grandfather was telling me something, you know, about the past. And he said, now, I know you don't care about this now, but someday you will. And he was right.
Yes.
Well, Roseanne, you mentioned that you can be affected by resistance from things that happened in the past without even being conscious or having a conscious memory of those things. And I was really intrigued by the story of Amy or Ami, I don't know how it's pronounced, that you included in the book. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
I'd love to. I don't know what this woman's name is, because when I went back and did more research, the doctor's name was recorded, but the patient's name wasn't. Apparently she was unimportant. Called her Amy. And what happened was, this was about 1906, I think it was, around that time, and there was a woman in France who had an injury that made it impossible for her to form new memories. So she could remember everything that happened to her up to the time of the accident, but she couldn't remember anything that happened to her after that accident. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like Drew Barrymore's 51st Dates movie.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the movie, she gets to remember the whole day, and when she falls asleep, then her memory resets. In reality, the memory reset was much faster than that. This woman could remember something, you know, something that happened for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. So every time her doctor came in to consult with her, he had to introduce himself to her as if it was the first time they were meeting, because for Amy, it was the first time that they were meeting. And so being kind of a, you know, sort of guy who wonders about things, he wondered what would happen if he put a straight pin between the fingers of his right hand, and when he introduced himself and shook hands with Amy, she'd receive this unexpected sharp jab in her palm, you know, real harmless, really, but totally unexpected and painful. And so he did this, and she jumped back, and he apologized, and then he left. And he waited the 10 or 15 minutes that it would take for her memory to reset. Then he went back in without the pin in his hand this time and offered his hand, you know, offered to shake hands with her and introduced himself, and she refused to shake his hand. And she had never done this before. She'd always been willing to shake his hand. And so when he pressed her and said, you know, won't you shake hands with me, she said, isn't it all right that one simply chooses not to shake hands? And she was adamant that she didn't want to shake his hand. Now, she has no memory that 15 minutes ago he's just hurt her hand, but she is not willing to shake his hand. And when he presses her even further, she says, well, perhaps you have something in your hand, a pin or something. And she has no conscious memory of this. So the doctor speculated, and research has later proven, that there are two memory systems. There's the memories that we have conscious recollection of, and then there are memories that we have no conscious recollection of, but are still available to our limbic system, sort of the mammal part of the brain, and that those memories can affect our behavior. So was Amy right to refuse to shake the doctor's hand? I think so. But she had no reason. She couldn't say, well, I don't want to shake your hand, or I don't want to write because you just hurt me, or my third grade teacher insulted me and embarrassed me in front of the whole class. We don't have the conscious recollection of it. But just because you can't remember why you're feeling resistant doesn't mean you don't have a very legitimate reason to feel that way.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, good point.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Roseanne Bain, author of Around the Writer's Block, Using Brain Science to Solve Writer's Resistance. One of the nice things about this book is that it, in a sense, it lets us off the hook for feeling guilty about not writing. and instead it helps us understand what's going on.
Yeah, that's one of the saddest things for me is when I see someone who, see a writer or talk with a writer or a student who assumes that if they're not writing, it's because they're lazy or they're undisciplined or they don't have the willpower that they need. I had one student who said, I've taken a lot of law classes. I really want to write, but I'm not writing, and maybe the resistance is just a sign that I should give up, and, you know, that I don't have what it takes to be a writer, or I don't want it enough. And I said, I think the opposite is true. I think the fact that you keep taking classes and you keep coming back is a sign that you do want to write. And the fact that you're facing the resistance is just even more evidence of how much you want this. What happens is the cortex is the part of our brain that wants to be creative. That's the part of us that can come up with new stories and is the storyteller part of us and that wants that. And the cortex isn't always in control. And it does a very bad job of recognizing when it's not in control. So the cortex just makes up stories to explain why we're not doing something or why we did something that the cortex didn't choose. And unfortunately, those stories are often negative. And we're telling ourselves bad things about ourselves that are not true.
So if the cortex is not in charge, what is?
What happens is that the limbic system takes over, basically. Daniel Goldman in Emotional Intelligence called it an amygdala hijacking. I think of it as a limbic system takeover. If you take your thumb and you assume that's your brain stem, that's the most primitive part of the brain that's in charge of respiration and digestion and big muscle group movement and reproduction, all those basic things, that's what's sometimes called the reptile brain. And part of what that part of the brain does is it decides where we should focus our attention. If you put your thumb across your palm and then fold your fingers over your thumb to make the kind of fist that apparently you should never use if you're in a fist fight because you'll break your thumb. So if you fold your fingers over it, then your fingers are like the limbic system, which is sometimes called the mammal brain. It's the emotional brain. It's the part of us that has the fight or flight instinct. All mammals will freeze, and then we'll decide whether we're going to fight or run away. That's the part of the brain that decides that. And then if you take your other hand and you fold it over your fist, that is the cortex. That's the so-called human brain. It is, in terms of evolution, it's the most recent brain. That is the part of us that can plan for the future, that can predict future outcomes from current actions, that motivates us, that has awareness of our mortality and morality, that has language and symbolic use, mathematics, all of that. The cortex, when that part's in charge, we want to write, and we do write. But what happens is, if you are threatened in any way, the part of the brainstem, the reticular activating system, is a sort of toggle switch, and it will switch the cortex off and the limbic system on. And it switches the limbic system on because that part of the brain is faster. That is the instinctual part that gets us out of the way of speeding trucks or an angry boss or a snake that's about to bite you. The cortex takes more time to make decisions, so that part can't be in charge during emergency situations. So when the limbic system takes over, the primary thing is just to keep you safe, keep you alive, keep you functioning. And that part of the brain doesn't care about writing. So when your limbic system is in control, you won't write. You'll be resistant. And so many of the ways that people experience resistance is a form of paralysis or a form of flight, running away, or fight, criticizing yourself. Mm. So that's where the resistance comes from. It's the instinctual response from the limbic system that basically shuts the cortex off. And the only way to get the cortex to turn back on is to physically relax.
And you have some suggestions for how to do that.
Yes, I do. Right there in the in chapter 9, I believe it is, we have a whole list of ways to relax.
Well, I'm sure that you can use that for many other things besides writing, too. I mean, just doing basic things that you have to do that you don't want to do.
Well, any time that you've feel stressed, mm-hmm. you're going to kick your limbic system in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's why it's so hard to change habits. It's it explains why we end up saying and doing things that we later regret. It's because the limbic system's taken over.
So generally, I mean, you have a sort of a plan for how to help keep your cortex in control.
Right. One of the three basic habits that I recommend is self-care. And self-care in general keeps your brain functioning creatively, keeps the cortex in the driver's seat for the most part, keeps that part of your brain functioning and making decisions. And there are five forms of self-care that I highly recommend. One of those is meditation. And meditation has a profound effect for relaxing you in the moment. So if you sit down to write and you suddenly feel an urge to pop up and look for the answers in the refrigerator, by the way, they're not there, I've checked.
Oh, come on.
Are you sure?
I'm sure I've checked. Just this morning I checked. And that urge to pop out of the writing space I'll just check my email or whatever. In that moment, you're experiencing a little mini limbic system takeover, and what you need to do is to relax in that moment. And so if you can just close your eyes and focus on your breathing, just your breathing, the air coming in and going out, maybe just repeating to yourself, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in, breathing out, I know I'm breathing out, that can relax you enough to have the toggle switch in the brainstem flip your cortex back in charge. My mother used to tell me to count to 10 when I was angry and upset about things, and I was a fairly dramatic adolescent and child, so I was often angry, upset, outraged, was a common experience for me. And I can tell you, when you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, nothing for you. If you count each breath, 1, and then you breathe in, 2, if you count to 10 that way, it does relax you at the moment. So there's the benefit of focusing on your breathing, which is at the heart of any form of meditation. There's the immediate benefit. But the other piece is that meditation as a practice, it affects how the brain not only functions, but how it's structured. So when they did MRIs of the Buddhist monks who study with the Dalai Lama, they found significant differences in their brains compared to people who were not meditators to that extent. And even if you meditate on a small level, it affects your brain. So it changes the structure. It also changes how the brain functions. And one of the things that it does is to increase activity in the left prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that inhibits the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that is the star cause for the limbic system takeover. So meditation as a general practice makes you less reactive. When you do get resistance, it's easier to get past it. It won't last as long. Those limbic systems are going to occur, the limbic system takeovers will occur less often. They'll be less intense, and they won't last as long. So you'll be able to get your creative cortex back online and keep it online more. So that's one of the five primary forms of self-care that really has a significant impact on your ability to keep writing.
Well, self-care is one of the three kind of overriding habits that you recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to kind of talk about those three and how they fit together?
Sure. Just self-care, the meditation piece, also getting adequate sleep is really important. A sleep-deprived brain is incapable of creativity. It's also...
You made Caroline yawn when you said that.
No, I never get enough sleep. I never get enough sleep.
I know. As you get older, it seems to get harder to get enough sleep.
Yeah.
But it's really important that we do everything we can to practice good sleep hygiene. or take naps or do whatever it is you need to do to get sleep, because sleep restores the brain. It allows us to really solidify what we've learned in the day. It gives us the opportunity to actually work on problems while we're sleeping. If you think about something that you're struggling with in your writing, if you think about it before you go to bed, you often wake up with a solution. So, and sleep actually helps helps us in so many ways, physically and mentally. And if for no other reason, then sleep deprivation will cause you to lose muscle mass and gain weight and age faster.
Wow.
That alone is motivation.
I'll say.
Of course.
So there's meditation, yeah. There's sleep, giving yourself time to focus, pay attention. Exercise is another primary benefit for the brain. It increases the blood flow. It increases the oxygen. It does a lot of wonderful things for the brain. Exercise is really important. And also play, giving yourself opportunities to play in a recreation kind of thing. Those are the five forms of self-care. And those intersect with process, which I mentioned earlier, which is creative play just for the sake of creative play. It's showing up and coloring or knitting or playing with Play-Doh. It can be gardening. It can be anything that you do just because it's kind of fun to do it, and you just let yourself have that. It's a way of kind of tapping into the right hemisphere of the brain. It's a way of taking the left hemisphere offline so much, kind of balancing that, getting those two hemispheres to collaborate. Process is another of, it's the second of the three habits. And the third habit that I recommend is product time, which most people think of, they talk about writing time, and the problem with calling it writing time is that you think of it as, you know, fingers on the keyboard or pen on the page, and the truth is there are six stages in the creative process, and in only one of those six stages do you actually have fingers on the keyboard or pen on the page. So if you call it writing time, you think of drafting, writing, editing, revising, you think of those kinds of things. But there's a whole host of things that we have to do as writers to bring our writing forward and get it out there into the world. We have to research, we have to talk to people, interview people, we need to get the ideas, we need to be paying attention, we need to incubate the idea, we need to write it down, edit it, all those things. So I call it product time rather than writing time, because I think it encourages people to think about all of the things that they need to do for writing.
That's very good advice. Very good. And another way of not feeling guilty, because sometimes people feel guilty about, they're supposed to be spending this time writing and they're doing these related things and they feel guilty about that. And that's not productive.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't recognize that, you know, sometimes you just need to be in that space. I tell my students that if they commit to 15 minutes of product time, they show up in the writing space and they do nothing but sit in the chair and stare at the space where the ceiling meets the wall and wonder about their writing, that counts. As long as you're not playing computer solitaire or other video games, you're not clearing your desk, you're not looking for answers in the refrigerator, if you're available to your writing, that counts for product time. As long as you're available.
And is there something magic about 15 minutes?
There is something absolutely magic about 15 minutes. 15 minutes is a commitment that is small enough to be doable. I encourage people to commit to no more than 10 or 15 minutes. For some people, it's as small as 5. It needs to be an amount of time that's so small you'll do it no matter what. So no matter what else is happening in your life, you've got the hot water heater exploded, the dogs, you know, cut the paw, or the cat's throwing up, or the kids flushed something unmentionable down the toilet. Whatever is going on, you can lock yourself in the bathroom or sneak into your office or sit in your car and get your 10 or 15 minutes no matter what. 15 minutes, you want to keep it small enough that it's not scary. You know, it's only 15 minutes. And when it's only 15 minutes, your limbic system doesn't have to kick in because it's not scary, so you can actually show up. And you'd be amazed how much you can get done in 10 or 15 minutes if you're consistently showing up for it. people who think they need these huge blocks of time keep waiting for the huge block of time that never arrives.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the people who are doing 10 or 15 minutes 4 or 5 times a week are making amazing progress because they keep showing up.
Now, right. If you commit to 15 minutes, that doesn't mean you have to stop at the end of 15 minutes.
No, it's just 15 minutes is the commitment. And then you might set a target beyond the 15-minute commitment. You might say that my target is 2 hours. When I was finishing the manuscript for this book, my targets were 6 or 7 hours a day. But I never committed to more than 15 minutes.
Oh, boy.
That is, you show up no matter what. The target, if you get on a roll and you want to keep going, you can. You reserve the time. But if you feel done, you know, after 15 minutes or 2 hours or 4 hours, you can stop then. No guilt, no recrimination. You showed up for your 15 minutes. You honored the commitment, and you made great progress. And those targets are stretch goals. They're something that you're shooting for, but they're not something that you feel guilty about not making. Because you never know. You're doing something creative. You're doing something brand new. You can't predict how long it's going to take. Mm.
Now, in your book, you say that 15 minutes is usually enough to get past initial inertia.
Right. That's initial inertia. I love Newton's laws. A body at rest tends to stay at rest.
Body
and a person
motion.
Not writing tends to continue not writing.
Right.
So you need just this extra little oomph. You think about it, think about yourself as a little matchbox car sitting at the top of the speed ramp. And there's this little bar that keeps the car from flying down the ramp. And you've got all this potential energy, physicists would say, because you're at the top of the ramp. And once you get past that little bump, you know, go, you know, zooming down the ramp. That's what writers have. We have all of our experience. We have our insight. We have our perspective. We have the inclination. We have everything we need, and we're sitting there at the top of the ramp. And you need just a little bit of something to get past that initial inertia, to get yourself rolling. And that's what 15 minutes can do, because it's only 15 minutes. You know, I can put off throwing a load of laundry in or emptying the dishwasher or anything else that seems to be so important. I can put that off for 15 minutes. It's not like I'm saying I'm never coming back. And once you get into the 15 minutes, sometimes you are done after 15 minutes, but sometimes you're on a roll and you're happy and you want to keep going. It's the initial anxiety. And so it's just that little oomph to get past it.
Well, Roseanne, let's talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book and how you went about doing it and, you know,
researching
and whether the research came all before the writing, you know, what your process is.
My process was that I was teaching at the Loft, and I kept finding all these really cool little bits of information about the brain, and I started becoming a kind of a, you know, informal amateur brain geek. Oh, and here's the thing about the amygdala, and then I'd be telling people about the amygdala, or here's the thing about the cingulate gyrus, and, you know, all these terms that I was in love with. And so I started pulling that together into a class at the Loft that we initially called Resolving Writer's Resistance, and then we called it Around the Writer's Block, and now I think it's Finding Your Way Around the Writer's Block. But that class became sort of the genesis of the book.
Now, what is the Loft?
Pardon?
What is the Loft?
Oh, the Loft Literary Center here in Minneapolis is a gem in the literary world. It's a place where writers teach other writers. It's the country's oldest and largest literary center, place for writers and reading, and a place where writers read and readers come. And we have a fabulous youth program. It's just a fabulous place. And they do offer online classes, so you don't have to be in the Minneapolis area to benefit from the fabulous instructors at the Loft right now. You can do it online.
Wow, that's great. And is it affiliated with the university, or is it a separate nonprofit?
It's a separate nonprofit organization. It's been around for like 30, 35 years.
Yeah,
I've been
a friend of mine took a class there years ago, and I came up with her and just hung out for a day, and it was a wonderful space.
It is a great space. Were you in the new open book building?
I think so, but I'm not. How long has it been there?
I don't know. 10 years?
Okay, so yeah, because it would have been sometime in the last 10 years.
Yep. So. Yeah, it's a fabulous place.
Cool. All right, so
I am so grateful to the law for letting me, you know, kind of play around with these crazy brain ideas and form a class and teach and practice things and learn so much from my students. It really is a gift.
Okay, so you have this class, and then all of a sudden one day you say, you know, I should write a book from this?
Yeah, so I decided that this would be a really good book. I took a class at the Loft, taught by Ralph Blythe, on writing a book proposal. I had worked on a book proposal before and had done some polishing and kind of thought I had it in pretty good shape. I wrote the first 4 chapters. I took Ralph's class and learned a lot about how to, you know, shift the proposal to being something that editors could really get connected with. And I started shopping it around a little bit, and I wasn't getting really great response, but I kept revising it and working with it. And in January, I said, this is it. I'm done farting around. I'm going to see this book out this year. I'm either going to, if I don't have an editor or an agent by June, I'm going to start researching self-publishing and just move forward. I'm not going to fart around anymore, is what I told myself. In March of that year, I was at an agility trial with my dog, which is running obstacle courses with the dog. It's really very fun for me and my dog. I was at this trial, and I was sitting in the bleachers chatting with some other people. And one woman, Chris, who I've known for years, mentioned that she had been at a conference. And the thing about agility is we're all dog geeks. So we talk about our dogs, but we don't talk about our jobs very much. So Chris said she'd been at a conference, and I said, oh, was it business or pleasure? And she said something penguin. And I said, what's a penguin? Might have been a new agility term that I didn't know about. And Chris said, Penguin Books. And I said, oh, I have heard of them. So I asked what she does for Penguin. She told me she was a sales rep. And I said, oh, I'm on the supply side. I'm a writer. So we started talking about writing. She asked about my first book. I told her that Tarcher had been interested in it, but it ended up not being published with Tarcher. We chatted. And she said, you know, if you ever have anything that you'd like the editors at Tarcher to see, I can pass it along for you. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I happen to have a proposal that I'm just putting the finishing touches on. And bless her, Chris meant what she said. So I sent her the proposal. She looked at it. She forwarded it to the editor-in-chief at Tarcher with a wonderful endorsement. Mm. And Tarcher called me. And it was quite possibly the easiest opportunity to get a book in print that I've ever heard of or experienced. It was absolutely fabulous. And we entered into the verbal agreement in June of that year, when I said I would have an editor or an agent. Wow. I had both at that point.
Wow.
Actual contract, by the time it went through legal and everything else, was, I think, August before we officially signed it.
And then from that point, how long until the book was finished?
About 2 years.
Wow.
I had from June until the following March to finish writing the book, because I had written the first 4 chapters and outlined the entire book, which is what nonfiction publishers are looking for. They don't want you to write the whole book. They want to have some input into it. So the contract was to finish the manuscript by March. I turned it in. Then we started the editing process. Gabby Moss is my editor at Tarcher, and she is fabulous. She had a real gift for asking me, leaving little editorial questions, little notes, you know, not saying do this or do that, but just asking a question. And my initial response, of course, was, well, of course I meant it that way. That's the way I wrote it. I wrote it that way for a reason. And then I'd think about it a little bit, take the dogs for a walk, and I'd think, oh, yeah, well, I could do it this way. Oh, this could be so much better. Oh, I'm going to do it this way. And it was just the way that she could ask a question that was really helpful. and very supportive. And when I was in a place of, I'm not sure if this book's any good, she wrote me this fabulous, encouraging letter. And, you know, you don't always get an editor who's going to be able to have the time to actually work with you to develop the book and make the best of it that you can. I was very lucky and blessed to have Gabby be able to do that. And I appreciate Tarcher, you know, giving her as an editor the opportunity to do that. It's becoming more rare where editors actually have the time to work with writers in that way.
Now, Roseanne, you had published a book in, I believe, 1999 called The Dancing in the Dragon's Den, Rekindling the Creative Fire in Your Shadow. Were things much different in the publishing process of that one than it was with this?
In many ways, yes. That book was rejected. I had a very easy time finding an agent for that book because of the way some things happened. Mm-hmm. And then it was rejected like 50 times.
Whoa.
Finally, an editor with Nicholas Hayes, which was an imprint of Samuel Weiser, which is now Red Wheel Weiser, picked up the book. I misspoke. The book was picked up by another publisher, and I worked with an editor. We were ready to go, had the cover ready, and then that publisher decided to change their focus, and they weren't going to publish my book anymore. So I got to keep the advance. They gave me the artwork for the cover and all the interior work, and that's when my agent went back to Nicholas Hayes and made the arrangement to have the book done there. So Nicholas Hayes is a small publisher, and I was blessed that they kept my book around until they sold out the initial printing. So, you know, years and years my book was available on the backlist.
Great.
And it's only just now become unavailable. So if you see a used copy somewhere, snatch it up because they're not printing anymore. But I was very lucky in that sense to be with a small publisher because they kept it so long. A larger publisher might not have.
Right, right.
Now I'm feeling very blessed because Gabby has told me with Tarcher that they rarely remainder writing books, that they tend to keep them around for a long time. I've got a fabulous publicist, and I'm just delighted to be working with Tarcher.
Do you have any other books in the works?
I have another book that I'm thinking about, another nonfiction book about creative polarities, things that are sort of both and, like breathing in and breathing out, creating and destructing are connected. You know, input, reading, research, and then output, writing and producing. There's these things where we have to do both and we sometimes get overly attached to one end of the polarity, and that's when we get into trouble. That's the next nonfiction book. I'm also playing around with a novella that I wrote a couple of years ago. I've got some ideas for rewriting that and probably expanding it. The novella is sort of the bastard child in literature. It's too short to be a novel and too long to be a short story. Although with e-books and the internet, the novella has new legs, perhaps, new potential.
Right, yeah. I've bought a couple of those on my Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, yeah, your website says you're seeking agent and publisher for science fiction novels.
I have a science fiction novel that I put on the shelf for a little while. I'm going to dust it off and send it to my agent and see if there's anyone in her office that might be interested in representing it. It was fun to write, and it's hard for me to work on really more than one book-sized project at a time. So I have to make the decision of whether I'm going to focus primarily on promoting around the writer's block, but then secondarily writing the next nonfiction book, working on the novella, or working on the novel. So I'm going to have to pick one of those three.
Now, having been a successful nonfiction author, will that help you at all in getting your fiction published, or are they such different worlds that it's really not much of an advantage?
boy, I hope it's an advantage. I think the advantage is that I have an agent, and so I can ask her if there's anyone in her agency that might be willing to look at it. I have some people, you know, at Tarcher who might be willing to talk to other people in other parts of Penguin. So I have some people that might be able to help me, some networking, some connections.
Yeah.
But they are pretty different. And so we'll see what happens.
And the old saying, it's who you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's both what you know and who you know.
Oh,
because
yeah.
You can know an awful lot, but if you never run into people, never get a chance to share it, it doesn't do you any good.
That's true.
And you can have all the connections in the world, but if you haven't done your prep work and aren't ready, that doesn't do you any good either.
That is true.
I really think it's a combination.
Roseanne, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's talk about your upcoming visit to Iowa.
Yes, I am so excited. I'm going to be going to Des Moines on September 23rd. Working with Beaverdale Bookstore there in Des Moines. We're going to be doing a free workshop for writers from 1:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. So I hope that all the Iowa listeners might consider a journey to Des Moines. I think they're about 2 hours north and west of you in
Right,
Fairfield.
Right. So that's September 23rd?
Yes.
At Beaverdale Books. And what was the time again?
1:30 to 3:30.
And if people want to learn more about what you do, do you have a website?
I would love it if people would come visit my blog, which is www.baneofyourresistance.
I love it.
When your last name is Bane, spelled B-A-N-E, people say things like, you're going to be the bane of our existence.
Yep.
Haven't heard that before. I really don't want to be the bane of anyone's existence, but I am delighted and uniquely prepared to be the bane of your resistance.
Fantastic.
That's where that came from.
Well, Roseanne, thank you so much for joining us today on Writer's Voices. It was an incredible pleasure talking to you, and I highly recommend the book. There's a lot of good information. In fact, I might even start writing again.
You should.
I'm delighted to hear that. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Monica and Carolyn. I had a really wonderful time chatting with you.
Well, goodbye. Good. And, Caroline, do you have some parting words of wisdom for us?
I do. I picked up this little book yesterday, Life is a Gift, Don't Trash It, and it's by John Alston. And this one, just I thought this was great. If you don't control your mind, someone else will. All it takes is a good story.
Wow. And stay tuned now for Planet Earth Wild with James Moore, and I think he's interviewing Fiddling Granny, among other people. And if you're listening Monday morning, have a great week.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.